Before the rise of the Nazis, wouldn't you say meddling of Western powers or U.S. powers had something to do with that, because maybe workers' parties wanted to rise up and...
It's not a secret. Again, we have plenty of internal records. I mean, what's now called appeasement, you know, bad thing, appease the Germans, that was regarded as a sensible policy. 1937, the State Department described Hitler as a moderate who's standing between the extremes of right and left. And if he doesn't succeed, the left, the labor and disillusioned middle classes might get together and maybe even move toward the Russians or something, but in any event, have a kind of a worker-based leftist government, which the U.S. won't tolerate. Britain, even worse, they didn't want it. They had tight business interests with Germany. The U.S. did too, but the Britain much more so. So they were much happier to work with Hitler. In fact, you know, as late as 1938, they probably could have stopped the war. Germany wasn't ready for war then, but they wouldn't do it.
A 1937 report of the State Department's European Division described the rise of fascism as the natural reaction of the rich and middle classes in self-defense. When the dissatisfied masses, with the example of the Russian Revolution before them, swing to the left. Fascism, therefore, must succeed, or the masses, this time reinforced by the disillusioned middle classes, will again turn to the left. The report also noted that if fascism cannot succeed by persuasion in Germany, it must succeed by force. It concluded that economic appeasement should prove the surest route to world peace, a conclusion based on the belief that fascism as a system was compatible with U.S. interests. One of the books on this topic is Thank God They're on Our Side, and it shows you a history that I don't think is being taught in school, how greed has caused an enormous amount of misery throughout history. And that the quest for stability is really continuing the status quo of greed with a disregard for democratic rights of the people. Look at what they're willing to do to keep down the people. The so-called quest for stability, on whose terms? That's the key. Quoting from this book, page 86, this concern was heightened by the growing appeal and power of the left in many nations and the questioning of capitalism that the Great Depression engendered. While experimentation and change were called for at home, it was not a time for new initiatives abroad. Policies were pursued to enhance the status quo, not to challenge it. Moreover, globally, the economic crisis created a movement away from parliamentary or democratic government in many nations to a more authoritarian rule. There were no assurances that this upheaval was over or that the momentum might not swing to left-wing or radical nationalist movements. Given these circumstances and concerns, Roosevelt accepted and extended the policies and ideas of his Republican predecessors in most areas of the world. The tension between the U.S. desire for democratic governments and its quest for stability and non-radical political change was drawn even tighter during the 1930s. This would mean no fundamental changes in the ideology and policy towards right-wing dictatorships.
Over the past week, some have said it was indelicate of me to suggest that our top political priority over the next 2 years should be to deny President Obama a second term. But the fact is, if our primary legislative goals are to repeal and replace the health spending bill, to end the bailouts, cut spending, and shrink the size and scope of government, the only way to do all of those things is to put someone in the White House who won't veto any of these things.
I received an email with a list of quotes on it, Republican candidates and leaders saying that bad economic numbers help Republicans' chances in 2012. And on that email is one of your quotes from last year, where you said, quote, the single most important thing we want to achieve is for President Obama to be a one-term president. So how do you respond to those Democratic lines of attack?
Well, that is true. That's my single most important political goal, along with every active Republican in the country.
The birth certificate was produced in 2011. You continued to tell the story and question the president's legitimacy in 2012, 13, 14, 15,
yeah,
as recently as January. So the question is, what changed your
mind?
Well,
nobody was pressing it. Nobody was caring much about it. I figured you'd ask the question tonight, of course, but nobody was caring much about it. But I was the one that got him to produce the birth certificate, and I think I did a good job. Secretary Clinton,
also fought it. I mean, you know, now everybody in mainstream is going to say, oh, that's not true. Look, it's true. Sidney Blumenthal sent a reporter. You just have to take a look at CNN the last week, the interview with your former campaign manager, and she was involved. But just like she can't bring back jobs, she can't produce.
I'm sorry, I'm just going to follow up, and I will let you respond to that, because if there's a lot there, but we're talking about racial healing in this segment. What do you say to Americans?
Well, it was very, I say nothing. I say nothing because I was able to get him to produce it. He should have produced it a long time before. I say nothing. But let me just tell you, when you talk about healing, I think that I've developed very, very good relationships over the last little while with the African-American community. I think you can see that. And I feel that they really wanted me to come to that conclusion. And I think I did a great job and a great service, not only for the country, but even for the president, in getting him to produce his birth certificate.
Secretary Clinton.
He has really started his political activity based on this racist lie that our first black president was not an American citizen. There was absolutely no evidence for it. But he persisted. He persisted year after year because some of his supporters, people that he was trying to bring into his fold, apparently believed it or wanted to believe it. But remember, Donald started his career back in 1973 being sued by the Justice Department for racial discrimination because he would not rent apartments in one of his developments to African Americans, and he made sure that the people who worked for him understood that was the policy. He actually was sued twice by the Justice Department. So he has a long record of engaging in racist behavior. And the birther lie was a very hurtful one. You know, Barack Obama is a man of great dignity. And I could tell how much it bothered him and annoyed him that this was being touted and used against him. But I like to remember what Michelle Obama said in her amazing speech at our Democratic National Convention. When they go low, we go high. And Barack Obama went high, despite Donald Trump's best efforts to bring him down.
Mr. Trump, you can respond, then we're going to move on to the next segment.
I would love to respond. First of all, I got to watch in preparing for this some of your debates against Barack Obama. You treated him with terrible disrespect. And I watched the way you talk now about how lovely everything is and how wonderful you are. It doesn't work that way. You were after him. You were trying to. You even sent out, or your campaign sent out, pictures of him in a certain garb. Very famous pictures. I don't think you can deny that. So when you try to act holier than thou, it really doesn't work.
New study out, University of New Hampshire, says that more white people are dying than being born in 17 states. That's a third of the U.S. The big ones in that picture are Florida, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, West Virginia. Those comprise of 38% of the U.S. population. That's a big shift from 2004, when only four of the states of those 17 had more white deaths than births. Now, the net effect nationwide is there's about 100,000 more white people born every year as of the latest study, the latest numbers, than there are deaths. There was an increase of 5.8% during the financial crisis. There has also been a huge uptick since the financial crisis. It was already going, but it's really ramped up in the white population, particularly middle-aged men dying from opioid abuse, suicide, and problems associated with obesity, all things that happen when there is a cultural decline in a segment of the population. See, whether it's Obama's fault or Bush's fault or whatever, it's just our fault. What's happened is minorities haven't gotten any better. In fact, they've gotten worse. But at a rate, at a percentage, minorities have found a degrading cultural situation. But the white population, or at least a large segment of it, a large swath of it, has found an even more precipitous negative degradation, making it resemble a lot of what we've seen from minorities over the course of many years. I got to thinking when I was putting this together, I don't know why this thought came to my mind, but I thought about abortion for a minute. And I've always been concerned with why the black population and by their nature, more liberal than conservative, can tolerate Planned Parenthood, which was founded in the 1920s by a lady of the name Margaret Sanger. And the mission statement was to exterminate the black population through abortion because it was believed that they would use it far more per capita than anyone else. And this is some liberal, you know, a beacon of liberalism and progressive politics. And I always thought, wow, that's amazing. I can't understand how they could tolerate that. And then I looked at the numbers. Well, yes, the black population, which is 13% of the country, does conduct 37% of the abortions, almost threefold the number of the population. But 39% of the abortions are still white. So if you believe that the white population is somehow the cause of the racism and bigotry in the country, the white population is being exterminated far more quickly by abortion and things like Planned Parenthood than it is any other population. 8% are of other descent, 25% Hispanic. That makes some sense. But what's really in those numbers is not about the politics of it. It's about the reality of where we are as a country. We as a country have found ourselves in a situation where not only are minorities' conditions getting worse, but now the white population, or at least a large swath of it, is seeing an even more precipitous decline, such that it's turning to opioid abuse, heroin, suicide, and eating to soothe the anxiety and tensions, which is leading to a more rapid death. This is something we got to fix.
You have a chapter entitled Professor Obama. Why'd you choose those words?
The president is a very smart guy. I think he knows a lot about a lot of things. I think he would do a better job of dealing with others if he would spend less time trying to acquaint whoever he's talking to at the moment with his brilliance and more time listening. Just to draw a contrast between the president and the vice president. I've been in a number of major deals with the vice president that were important and worth doing for the country. He doesn't spend any time trying to convince me of things he knows I don't believe, and I don't spend any time trying to convince him of things that he doesn't believe. In other words, you don't waste any time on all of that. We get down to trying to figure out what we can do together because he knows how far I can go and I know how far he can go. I think the president would be better off. He's a brilliant guy. He's been successful in his political career and rising quickly to the top in American politics. But I don't think these sort of incessant lectures are very helpful in getting an outcome if you're in some kind of negotiation.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no wars, fine. Don't go crying for your money when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother, Von Mary Deese. Welcome to another episode of the Class War Battlefield Podcast. Donald Trump is the president. You heard several clips, of course, at the beginning of this episode, starting with the clip with Noam Chomsky. I wanted to play that because the rise of the Nazis The Nazis, of course, a lot of people think they're socialist. They're not specifically socialist. In fact, Hitler said on numerous occasions that they were never socialist and they could never be socialist. Indeed, socialism and communism, people, we lose sight of this, but the Western Eurasian countries, Britain, France, especially the upper elite, they look at communism and socialism as primitive. And I mean that, 100% primitive. They don't look at it as an evolutionary step forward. They don't look at it as an evolutionary step anywhere. They look at it as primitive. The idea, which at the heart of socialism and communism, which both come out of Africa, they both come out of the communal lives of indigenous people all over the world. That's how communal people lived, including some of the, quote, backwards people of Europe who were more self-sustaining. They look at it as a primitive way of living because you share everything and you have to have a social conscience. So what I do impacts everyone in the community. It impacts everybody in the nation. So I need to be thinking on that level. I'm not just one atom amongst many. No. In order for a piece of wood to be a piece of wood, you have to have every atom in that piece of wood committed to being a piece of wood. These people believe in competition. They believe in the what's often called the Iceman way of living, which is you have to battle and struggle for everything, except, by the way, when you become rich, and then you are still battling and struggling to keep your stuff, but as long as you stay on the right side of everybody who you're around, you're never going to lose it. You will never lose it. So with the rise of Nazism, I wanted people to really get it into their minds and remember and recall that Nazism was a right-wing party. Nazis were right-wing. Often people say, oh, well, they were nationalists. Or they'll say something along the lines, well, they were socialist, meaning that they were left-wing. I want to state once and for all, and I'll probably find myself saying this more and more times in the near future. The idea of the left, people always say left-wing, but the original left wasn't on wing. See, left or right, it's still the same bird. Realize that. Left or right wing, it's still the same bird. It's still capitalism. Therefore, you cannot claim to be a socialist and consider yourself left wing because you're a capitalist. That means you can't be a socialist. Capitalism works under completely different principles than socialism and communism. Understand that. The original left was considered left because they were left behind. They were quote, primitive. They were talking about agrarian and egalitarian, which is a word that we don't even use anymore. We equate it to equality, which egalitarian had a certain equalness to it, but it was more along the lines of solidarity. We understand that the person working in the mill can only work in the mill as long as the person working in the field is able to do what they can do. And the person in the field's job is only made easier by the tools that they craft from the metals and the other raw materials which are drawn out of the ground and from nature by people who work in the mines. So the person in the mill ultimately is reliant on the person in the mind. But then the person in the mind has to be reliant on the people who are making his equipment, and the cycle continues. This is what egalitarian really is talking about, which is why you notice people will use the term egalitarianism, but or I'm an egalitarian, but they'll never define it.
You never see anybody actually running for office underneath the guise of being an egalitarian. You'll see people running under socialism, communism, workers' party, things like that. But even the workers' party isn't Trump. They're talking about egalitarianism, but they don't want to talk about it. So I needed to open this up. I needed you to come to this podcast with the idea in your mind already that Nazism was a right-wing conspiracy. It was a fascistic organization which was built on white nationalism, built on not economic rationalism or even economic nationalism. It was kind of built on this concept of economic solidarity. Yet, behind the solidarity concept was this rigid, rugged state apparatus, which if you didn't show the right amount of solidarity, if you didn't fall into line and listen to the authoritarian government, then you could be in a world of hurt. This is right. It was right-wing, authoritative concepts through and through. In fact, it was so right that it wasn't even on, it was barely considered capitalism anymore. People say, well, you know, the government guaranteed you jobs and stuff like that, so that's definitely socialistic. It is socialistic, but the problem with it is, even in the old social programs, you had an apparatus to communicate your grievances. So there was always, and there was never one leader. There was always a group. And when I say a group, I mean a group. I'm talking about a council of people. I'm not talking about a congress of people who still have to be subjugated to the whims of the king or the president. No. This was a group of people who were on equal footing and could check each other. And even then, there was ways for the people to register their discontent with the people with the individuals who were on that council. So you lost favor with the majority of the people in your commune, in your community. You can be ostracized, kicked off that council without anyone feeling bad, because you knew when you were getting on that council that you had to do what was best for everybody. Not what was best for business, not what was best for you or the council. You had to do what was best for everybody. And I see some of that in the, quote, experiment of American democracy. The only problem is Europe, Western Eurasia, has a long history of authoritative governments. They are not prone to build up mechanisms that were used in Native indigenous communities, that were used in African indigenous communities, all over the world. They are not prone to that. They usually have one leader. And that leader fights it out, dukes it out with other leaders to become that one leader. And that's the history of Europe. So I want you got to understand that point. You got to understand the depth of that, because people have been throwing around the idea of fascism and Nazism since Donald Trump, even before he was elected, people were throwing it around. People have thrown it around even more since he's been elected. The problem with that is part of fascism is racism. A major part of it is, if you didn't belong to the right group of people, you exercised. Now, when fascism was implemented during the 70s and the 60s and the 80s in South America and elsewhere, it couldn't be overtly racist because, and I really hesitated to say that, because you still had tribes competing with each other, and when one tribe was placed in office by the West, they would then discriminate and exercise racism I'm sorry, let me back up. They would exercise, discriminate. Because it wasn't racism. Racism is very distinct, and it's a Western culture problem. But they were exercising prejudice, they were exercising discrimination, and they were even exercising legal exclusion to many extents. And they were exercising caste in many instances. But again, racism is a purely Western cultural problem. And I want to definitely make that right. But when it was put, when fascism was implemented there, they would definitely implement caste. Now, oftentimes the lighter-skinned people would get favor in those countries against the darker-skinned ones. A great example of this, actually, is noticeable right now because of Shakira. Shakira, who is Colombian in Arabic, which I didn't know about the Arabic, but I knew about the Colombian, she actually does not look like most Colombians. Most Colombians are dark-skinned. And yet, looking at her, you would think most Colombians wore white-skinned, blonde hair. But they are not. I think the last numbers I saw was less than 10% are classifiable as white. So, you know, it's, like I said, it's a Western cultural problem. But again, I needed you to see this. I needed you to have this in your mind immediately. It's kind of the old concept of opening up space, opening up sacred space for a spiritual concept, opening up sacred space. So I needed that to jump out at you immediately. Now, while I'm thinking about it, let me just say, I really want to dedicate this to a brother who I wish was still among us in here, because he, I think, would have had a lot to say. He would have had a lot to say, and it's sad to me that he's not here, and that would be Tracker of Truth, Michael Rupert, because I think he would have definitely seen this in a unique way, and would have been very beneficial to helping us move through this period in time of increasing anxiety. After that first clip, I then went into the clip on Trump and the birth certificate, and I wanted to remind people of this, because this is why Donald Trump was really touted by the alt-right, was because he stood up when very few politicians would and said, yes, 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 I do believe Barack Obama may be an immigrant, may not be eligible to actually be president, and I need to see his birth certificate. That endeared him amazingly to the alt-right. Now, I want to point out here, I don't believe Donald Trump is an alt-right enthusiast. As was mentioned at the end of that specific clip, I had heard about his issues in the 70s with the fact that he didn't want to hire, he didn't want to allow black people to live in his buildings. I had heard that before. So, but I'm not ready to say that the man is part of the alt-right. I will say that I believe he is an opportunist, he is a salesman, and he looked at this budding, this groundswell of energy, which is of the alt-right, and he said, I know how I can do this, what I can do, how I can use this to my advantage, if I really want to be president, boom. And he did. I don't believe he necessarily believes everything they believe, but at the same time, he's given me no reason to believe that. I guess that's just a hope. Because truthfully, and I do mean truthfully, these people are worried about extinction. And that is why I'm going to skip around a little bit here. Nope, actually, excuse me, I'm not going to skip around. But that's why I put the clip on the new study about the European deaths. Now, people need to understand, this is actually very serious, because this is why we are seeing, well, economics are definitely there too, but this is why we're seeing the rise of this nationalist fervor. As was pointed out in several podcasts that I've listened to since Donald Trump was elected, you have a massive influx of immigrants. And a lot of these immigrants are brown and black. You have these this influx of immigrants going into former colonial powers. And the people there who are already struggling economically, and of course, who have a massive history of blaming the other person who don't look like them, they are angry at these people for basically coming to the powers that conquered them. Now, this is funny to me because, really honestly, if Europe had just, I don't know, acted civilly to all of these people, or civically to all of these people, they would have easily stayed in their homes and, you know, built up lives and built up good lives and wouldn't be coming to Europe. But because Europe and America have wanted to play in basically their backyards and other people's backyards, they have created a hell for the poor. And now because these people can, they are leaving those homelands and they are going to the places where it is the most stable. Now, the idea of the birth rate is actually apt. I have seen several, in the last year, I have seen several articles in major newspapers. I'm not talking about alternative weeklies. I'm not talking about alternative papers. I'm talking about major newspapers. Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, probably USA Today too, I think. But these articles are, all of them to a T, are talking about declining birth rates among white people, among Euro-Americans, among Europeans in general. Think about it. You have 17 states in the United States that have falling white birth rates. For the first time, I think it was last year, the majority of the babies born in the United States were non-white. They were non-white. Now, you got to understand what this means, because most people think when you say non-white, you mean pale. No, 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 no. There is actually a classification system which is legally binding in this country. I don't know the USC code, the United States code. I don't know it verbatim, and I don't even know the numbers, but I've seen it. I have seen it. And it says, if you are from certain areas of the world, you are considered white. If you are from other areas of the world, you are considered not white. Presently, the United States is undergoing kind of a transformation where the declining European-American population is now integrating the lighter-skinned Hispanic into the fold. So now the lighter-skinned Hispanic is now going from being Hispanic to being white. You're seeing this all over the country. So when you have a Jimenez or a Martinez or a Masonias, then a lot of these people, if you look at many of them, they have a brown complexion, but they are lighter skin. And in many areas of the country, they could actually pass for white, and they would be accepted as white. They are honorary white people. This has happened with many of the Arabs. With many of the Arabs, actually. They have included them as being white. This has happened with a lot of Egyptians. Some Libyans all over, actually most of North America is considered white. They consider Ethiopians white. And I'm not talking about the Africana people who are from Europe. I'm talking about straight up black-boned Ethiopians. They try to call them white. Why are they doing this? Because it has to do, one, with culture. And when I say that, I do mean white people. Why do white people do it? It has to do with culture, and it has to do with actually bolstering their numbers. Think about it. You're born into a club that excludes you from a lot of things. And then overnight, a switch is flicked. And you are let out of that club and entered into a new one where doors open for you. And this is the selling point. When Barack Obama went to Africa, oftentimes he was selling the American way of life. And what that American way of life meant for most Africans was, join us and become white. Join us and become white and watch doors open for you. Play with us, have our back, and watch doors open for you. That's the American way of life that he was selling in Africa. Let go of your African heritage. I watched part of his speech in Kenya, and it was sad to me to see the number of brothers and sisters over there wearing blonde weave. Blonde weave. Seriously? Blonde weave. But the birth rate is a serious concern. In Europe, they have had declining birth rate for 15 or 20 years. In fact, I was just watching a video from 1996, a speech from 1996, and the individual in the speech was actually talking about birth rates then. He was talking about declining birth rates and the fact that they had predicted, that scientists were predicting, by 2000. America, the United States of America, could be seeing a negative birth rate. 2000, this was in 96. So the fact that presently, just last year, was the first year that babies, the amount of babies born, the majority of them were non-white, it says something. It makes me wonder if those numbers are accurate. I mean, I gotta assume they are. But it makes me wonder. Birth rates, though, are important. And again, that's something that I need you to be very cognitive about and very aware. If you go and you look at new white nationalist alt-right video propaganda, you'll see a lot on children, on birth rates, on protecting whiteness from extinction. The extinction aspect has to do with the birth rate. The extinction aspect has to do with the birth rate. And then there is Mr. Mitch McConnell, which I included two clips about him. The one where he was saying they wanted to make Obama a one-term president, and then the one on Professor Obama. I included that because I really honestly needed to remind people about the fierce opposition that was already in place when Barack Obama was sworn in as president. And in fact, I was watching a video on, it was really a compilation of information on the racists just, I don't even know what to call it. It was kind of a racist deluge of just material, of letters, of emails. I mean, these were from public officials. But I wanted to remind you of that. And I have seen, actually, just blatantly negative vitriol of white people celebrating Donald Trump's ascension into the White House. And I had an experience myself with a individual who I would have considered a friend at one time. Now we're acquaintances, but It had nothing to do with Donald Trump, actually. But I had posted something on my Facebook page about, you know, I'm willing to give him a chance. I said, I'll give him a year, you know. Let's see what he's doing. Let's see what he got, you know, planned for the country. And this person, who I've known since we were in high school, I'm in my mid-30s now, he posted and was very gleeful about this and said, yeah, you know, I think we're going to be entering a new era of peace and prosperity, and it's going to be awesome for us, and blah, blah, blah. And I lit into him. And I told him where he could take that. I literally told him, I said, shove it. Because you and your conservative buddies disrespected Obama at every turn that you could. And he himself had disrespected me. He disrespected my parents, who are both, you know, ancestors now. And I have no respect for that. And I told him the only reason why he was so giddy was because his side won. But he was, him and the conservatives are just a bunch of sore losers. They're a bunch of sore losers. And Donald Trump is a wonderful representation of the negative white psyche, of the ego white psyche, where they believe they can do anything. They are confident in their ability to do anything without repercussion. They are confident in their ability to say anything without repercussion. He is a perfect representation of the massive white psyche. In fact, the clip that I played where he was discussing the birther concept, and, well, not the concept, but it was on birtherism, and he said, I think I've done well with, you know, I've made great strides in creating a relationship with black people, with African Americans. This is typical. This is actually, this is plucked straight from the white psyche. White people often do what they think they can do to black people, and then when asked about it, they say, what are you talking about? I'm excellent friends with black people. I know Jamal. I know Jarrell. I know Marcus. Look, I got black people coming out of me like, you know, I'm Martin Lawrence or something. Come on. He's a perfect, just, if God wanted to show white folks, this is why things are about to go really bad for you. He couldn't have done better but to put Mr. Donald Trump up there. And trust me when I tell you, I don't know how long it's going to take. But you know I keep saying it. I've said it many times before, and I'll say it again. And in fact, we're about to jump from the clips and kind of get into this a little bit. But there is a war. There is a civil war brewing against two factions, at least two factions, there's probably a third one waiting for the two to destroy themselves, of the elite. And Donald Trump is part of one of the factions, which is why the media, some media, was throwing everything they could at him to stop him. Other media was not. They faked it. They faked it. They didn't want to stop him. In fact, I often wonder if CNN wanted to stop him. They gave that man so much free publicity. They gave him so much free publicity. Hillary Clinton did not get that kind of a treatment. This isn't me defending Hillary. This is me pointing out a fact. Neither did Bernie Sanders. So you tell me, what side were they on? Now, I said we're going to jump from the clips because we are. There's something that's actually been going on, it's tremendously important today, And in fact, I was thinking about clipping on. I had actually recorded this episode once, and then I decided to go back and redo it because I didn't feel like the substance was good enough. But I was thinking about clipping on what I had said during that older episode, but I'm just going to go with the energy and talk to you right now. Over in Davos, Switzerland, D-A-V-O-S, the World Economic Forum is going on, or at least it was going on this past week. I think it's 2 weeks, so it might be going on this week, too. A wonderful report, which I actually just got. I have not read it completely, but I've seen several excerpts of it, detailing basically the economic forecast, mostly the economic conditions of 2016, but also, of course, offering some forecasting for 2017. Now, it must be always stated, it must be understood by the masses, what we are fed is not everything that's floating around in that forum. And we always have to understand that. So even though what I'm about to discuss for you, or with you, is apt, and we need to be paying attention to it, we need to also remember there are several white pages, there are several research pages and what have you that we as a people will never see that's being circulated. The real manifestos, the real memos of what they're going to be doing to treat the things which this page, which is condensed and edited for public release, what it's talking about. And we need to always remember this. Because 10 years from now, papers from this World Economic Forum will be released. And we'll be able to say, oh yeah, that's why that happened. Oh yeah, that's why that happened. But we need to remember, right now, presently, we are not seeing everything. We're seeing what they want us to see. Now, there might be leaks. I'm hoping there's leaks. But right now, we're seeing what they want us to see. And what is it that they want us to see? They want us to see that they are acknowledging that there is a crisis. There's a crisis. An economic crisis, a cultural crisis that is permeating Western civilization. It is the energy behind Donald Trump. It's the energy behind Brexit. It's the energy behind what's happening in Spain, what's happening in Italy, what's happening in Greece, even rumblings in France. My God, man, France? But yes, there is a fervor, a nationalist fervor, which is creeping up. And the nationalist fervor, although we call it white nationalism in this country, it's even worse than that. Because what, again, history. The majority of the people who are considered white right now were not considered white 100 years ago. Did you hear me? The majority of the people who consider themselves white right now was not considered white 100 years ago. To be white 100 years ago, mostly, you had to be of a certain stock. Oftentimes we say WASP, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant. But among among that WASP group were mostly Germanic people. And when I say Germanic people, I'm talking about the upper elite people. They consider themselves the white ones. The rest were not the white ones. But slowly and but surely, they learned from the United States, which extended whiteness to many other people. They slowly learned that if you extend whiteness, the idea of whiteness, to other people who had not been considered white but had been oppressed by the white people, then those non-white people who happened to look like the white people and had been oppressed by the white people would then do everything in their power to remain within that club. They looked at the United States with awe and said, huh, how do you control in the South a majority Negro, back then they said nigger, problem, or a majority Negro nigger population? You do it by convincing the impoverished, pauper, white person, who wasn't actually considered white by the main, by the aristocratic people of the South, you convince them that they are white, even if you're screwing them every day, no Vaseline. You convince them that they are white, and that their pain in the bum might just be constipation. But you still keep screwing them. But you convince them of that, and watch what happens. You give them little tidbits of responsibility over that despotic and beaten and mistreated group of niggers, and you congratulate them when they beat and kill and castrate and, in some cases, eat those niggers. And what they found was that these once non-white Europeans, when they were raised up and assimilated into the white culture, they enjoyed it. And they became brutal and ruthless. So they let them keep it. Because, hey, you need that brutal and ruthless mentality to not only rule over people, but, you know, destroy other people. So they let them keep it. Presently, though, you're seeing nationalism rise up again. And what does that actually mean for white people? Well, that's a problem, because nationalism, which in America we just say is white nationalism, but it's more complex than that. Nationalism in Europe isn't united. Hell, nationalism in the Americas is barely united. Texas is talking about seceding from the Union. I know it happens every so many years. I get that. California is talking about seceding from the Union. That one surprised me. Why is this happening? Well, because, see, in Europe, what you're having is you're having nationalist fervor rise, but it's not among white people. It's among certain ethnic groups. So you have the French, you have the Spanish, you have the British, you have the Italian, you have the Greeks, you have all of these people saying, oh, but my nation, it is my nation, not my color, it is my nation. And so now you're having a fragmenting of a once fragmented people who are just brought together because of, well, imperialism and pride. And that pride was stoked by an ability to annihilate, exterminate, brutalize, and oppress other people. And now that they can't do those things, overtly anyway, okay, somewhat not overtly, they have to color it a little bit differently, but you can't really send, you know, 250,000 of your men to just go and absolutely kill and annihilate a 200-300 mile region. Often you can't do that, but you just can't blatantly do that hardly anymore. So, you know, now that that's not happening, I like to say all of the frustration that was let out in the great bloodletting of imperialism, all of that frustration hasn't been let out in about 40 years. And now for people who are kind of savage in their actions with other people, that is, and don't get mad at me, look at the history it is. And by the way, celebrate your white history, but do me a favor, don't cry to me when I point out the savagery, okay? Don't cry to me on that. But anyway, now the group that has shown some great savage macho-ness towards the rest of the world is now doing what they've done, you know, for the last millennia. They're turning on each other again. And that's the problem with nationalism in Europe. So the World Economic Forum participants are worried about this. They're worried about it mainly because, well, you know, they have money in the game. But they're also worried about it because economically the West is not as strong and competent as it once was. And this is problematic. This is problematic. It's problematic because Europe's rising, Germany's rising, Chairman, who rises, and I said Europe. I mean, Russia is rising, China is rising, and, well, I used to be able to count India in among that group, but, not anymore. I didn't realize until recently that India was going through tremendous convulsions. This is something that the West has kept hidden, and I don't believe that it is coincidental. I think it's actually part of a concerted plan. They don't want people actually knowing what's going on in India because, well, I don't know if all of you know about the BRICS countries. Often they say BRIC, but there's actually an S on it. And the S stands for, well, let's start at the beginning. B is for Brazil. R is for Russia. I is for India. C is for China. S is for supposedly South America, South Africa, which always has bothered me. I just don't see the connection between the rest of those and South Africa. But out of those countries, and I like to be honest, if I had my way, I would drop the S and put a Z there. So it's still BRICS, but the Z would be Zimbabwe for Mr. Mugabe's wonderful, wonderful, amazing efforts. So I would really include Z in there. But digressing a bit, back to the BRICS, when you look at all of those countries, I think only two of them are not overtly being subjugated right now by internal conflicts. That would be Russia and China, which happen to be the biggest amongst the group. Brazil, if you don't know what's going on in Brazil, you need to really get caught up quickly. A constitutional crisis, a leader impeached and basically thrown out of office, and a lot of people understand that this is just in a United States manipulated coup. The person who replaced her is a fierce corporate, let's just call him a fascist, because that's what he is, fascist. And the crimes which is which they are lobbing at the former president, which was a woman, they have absolutely committed. There's evidence all over the place to say they committed the same crime, so they're hypocrites and they are fascists. This is standard United States operation. So it's just standard U.S. motive. India, like I said, just a nationalist fervor, a nationalist fervor is rising. The caste is quaking. People are not feeling comfy and cozy. There is real threat of political upheaval. Don't know about revolution, but definitely upheaval. And I, again, don't think that that's coincidence, considering how close India and China were getting. And then South Africa is also going through major convulsions. There has been major student protests. I'm not sure. I think a lot of this is, a lot of it down there is organic, having been looking at what's been going on over the last year and a half. But I also think there's manipulation going on. that takes a huge entry point away from China and Russia. However, you know, I mentioned a few moments ago that I thought that South Africa should be removed and Zimbabwe should be inserted. And there's a reason for this. Because Robert Mugabe has actually went and worked out deals with both Russia and China. And ultimately, Zimbabwe has an important role in Africa. It is literally the heartbeat of the whole continent. Where it is located, it has the potential to reset the, what I like to call the energy current of the continent, because it is so centrally located. If Mugabe is successful with working with China and Russia and perpetuating his body politic after he's gone, which, you know, the brother's 92. It might be 93 now, or 94. Ooh, either way, he's older. And so if he can perpetuate that, it is going to, like I said, it could change the dynamic of the continent, considering the United States right now is just shredding the north part of Africa, shredding it. AFRICOM is just, if you don't believe the United States created ISIS and Al-Qaeda, then really honestly take one look at what's happening in North Africa, where suddenly you have ISIS and Al-Qaeda all over the place, and they come on the heels of the United States moving in and establishing AFRICOM in the northern part of Africa. If you don't believe that is not coincidence, I cannot help you. But it's not coincidence. Trust me. It is not coincidence. So, what is going on in Davos, which we all need to be concerned about? They were talking. I apologize, I had to stop recording for a moment. But they were talking about the economic, or excuse me, the perception of the masses of people in Western civilization, of the fact that banks were bailed out after the 2008 crash, and the economic benefits of that bailout has not been seen by the mass of the people. Moreover, there is a perception, and I love kind of the word into this, I can't remember verbatim, but the perception of the masses of the people, as they put it, that the economic growth of the past two decades have really only went to benefit the upper elite, and the way they made it sound was that this was a mischaracterization, that the people were mistaken, that they had benefited also. You know, it's great when you see older people going through dementia, isn't it? I know it's not. It's sad. But damn, these people are just, I mean, you have to be head in a mountain to believe that that is actually the case, that this is a misperception. The reality is, it's not a misperception. It's true. When you can say that the top, not 1%, but 0.1% own over half of the wealth of the world, when you can say that, then it's not a perception. It's a reality. It's a reality. It is an absolute reality. I'm flabbergasted by that. I'm not sure if they understand though, because I guess if you're that removed, you know, I think about Robert Kennedy, and I think about what was said about him and how bored he was when he was in the Senate and how bored he was even before he ran for the Senate, and then he went to the Senate and he thought that he'd be doing good, and then he was extraordinarily bored being in the Senate because he realized, you know, it was just a bunch of blowhards doing nothing. And then he stepped outside of the Senate and started joining protests and going down and talking to real people and understanding what they need and why they needed it. And he's seen that the system was just rotten and wasn't working for the ordinary people. And that's when he decided that, yeah, maybe I need to run for president. And I think about that. And I think about how that was characterized by people who knew him, where he said that he had received a strong sense of self when he went and he started actually working and helping other people. And I wonder, are these people, one, because I do believe that some of them fall into this category, are these people psychopathic? And then two, are they that closed off where they can't actually see what the heck, that they can't see what's going on in the country? I mean, honestly. Now, granted, And this is where I actually was thinking about clipping the old show and posting some of it here. Because I talk in the old show. You know, actually, maybe I should do that. You know what? Here's a clip from the show that I recorded earlier. Because it's really apropos, and I don't believe I could do the same justice to this topic. So I'm going to insert it here. I know it's kind of unorthodox, but I'm still going to insert it here, and then I'll see you on the other side. The owner of Alibaba was saying that part of the economic problems which have been plaguing the United States is that it spent... I couldn't even believe this figure. It spent $14 trillion on war over the last 20 to 30 years. $14 trillion. Instead of building it or using it to build infrastructure and to build up the country. This is true. And in fact, you know, one of the things that Donald Trump has been getting praised for is the fact that he said, I want to put together a infrastructure program. Now, everyone in their mama has been praising him, including a lot of conservatives, a lot of poor conservatives. And this pisses me off to no end, because when Barack Obama came into office, he said, we need to spend money on infrastructure. The original stimulus plan that he had put together did not... Well, it included some tax breaks, but it almost, if memory serves me correctly, there was about $500 billion in infrastructure money that would have been allocated. The Republicans fought him tooth and nail on it. In fact, to be fair, they're already saying that they're going to fight Donald Trump on the infrastructure plan, which is absolutely ludicrous. Which is absolutely, any conservative, any Main Street conservative who can say that I'm not for infrastructure, but then they can talk about the greatest times in America, which was, look at what we did in World War II, look at what we did after World War II, look at the hard work that people put down to be able to be in the middle class. Anybody who can actually say that without a hint of irony, that the middle class in the United States was only built up because, guess what? The government spent billions of dollars. An estimation I saw was $120 billion over the course of 15 or 20 years to build up the white middle class. They spent $120 billion at a time period when $120 billion was $120 billion. I don't know what it would be today, but I'm wagering that it would be close to or over $1 trillion. That is how the United States built most of its freeways. That's how most of these buildings were constructed. If you look at the timetable of building construction, I guarantee most of the buildings you're seeing are... or even most of the overpasses and the roads that you were seeing, they were built between 1945, the mid-1930s, all the way through the mid-1960s. That's when the majority of this stuff was done. Now, that $120 billion only counts after World War II. It does not count what was done before World War II. It doesn't count that. Thinking about this reality that we need, that this country, and I keep saying we, but if history tells me anything, black people are going to take a wash on this. We're not going to get as much benefit from this. I know what Donald Trump's saying, but I know about the bureaucratic structure. And I know how it works. You don't put Jeff Sessions in the seat of your Justice Department if you plan on being just, fair, and righteous. You don't do that. But the fact of the matter is the United States needs to put probably, and I'm not even joking when I throw this around, they need to probably put $10 trillion into infrastructure. $10 trillion. Now, who's going to be willing to pay for that? And this is the other point, because everyone keeps saying, we don't have the money to pay for it. No. Wrong. If the Italian financial crises of 2010 didn't teach us anything, and it didn't teach most people anything, because most of you have no idea what I'm talking about. Do your research. Italy was having a huge financial problem at the time. They were, the money, there was a budget shortfall of several billion dollars. I don't want to say it was quite 100, it might have been 100. But it was significant enough to put the government in a position where it had to start looking at cutting social programs. Well, several astute, well-meaning journalists decided to ask a question. Okay. We have this budget shortfall. Why do we have it? Well, the government said, well, we're just, you know, we don't have the tax revenue. Well, these journalists went and they took a look and they said, oh, no. You do have the tax revenue, you just haven't went and collected it because a bunch of rich people don't want to pay their taxes. And that's the problem in the United States. Everybody gets angry about taxes going up, but nobody asks the question, well, why is the taxes actually going up? You know why the taxes are going up? Seriously. If you know a conservative, you clip what I'm about to say, clip it out, and send it to them. You know why your goddamn taxes are going up? Because rich people don't want to pay theirs. That's it, 100%. Oh, and then you're going to argue, of course, because I've heard it. Well, why should they have to pay? Why should they have to pay taxes? They've earned their money fair and square. Most rich people don't know what the word fair is, and they don't give a damn about squares. What they know is, I have power, I have prestige, and I can use it and wield it to get what I want. And what I don't want is to pay my employees a fair salary. I want to gouge them and make sure that I can make as much money as possible. And at the end of the day, after I make all that money, I don't want to pay my fair share to the social contract. I don't want to worry about that. That's what they say. That's what they think. I'm not saying all of them do it. But the majority of them do. And when I say majority, I ain't talking 52. I'm not talking 53. I'm not talking 60%. I'm talking 85%, 90%. Don't forget, we are seeing the maturing of the yuppie generation, of the young urban professionals generation, a generation which, by the way, and this is completely lost on people who have been looking at the Trump phenomenon, a generation which idolized Donald Trump. It's a generation which idolized Donald Trump. He was the quintessential professional of the 80s. The businessman that made deals with everybody. The businessman that never lost, or at least if he did, it never showed up in his earnings. I mean, go back to the movie Wall Street. Greed, for lack of a better name, is good. That was the whole mantra of the 80s, particularly the mid to late 80s. Greed, for lack of a better word, is good. What else are you going to call it? It's greed. You're being greedy. That's it. To be honest with you, you could have checked off every single thing that is on the supposedly the list of seven deadly sins. You could have checked them all off. And that was the young urban professional crowd. That was the era of big mergers, remember? Some of you might be too young to actually remember, so I get that. But that was the era of big mergers, hostile takeovers. overnight you would have small companies raided by corporate raiders. This was the culture that was bred in the 80s, which led to what's happening today. That's, people wonder why Donald Trump is, he's so beloved, especially by people 40 years and older, supposedly middle class, used to be middle class people. All right. Now you understand why I wanted to actually clip that. I couldn't say it like I said it earlier. So that's going to actually do it for the show. That's the last point that I wanted to make. And if you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know, just hit me up. I'll be honest with you, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know what else to say about the Donald Trump thing. I think there's too many unknowns right now. I think that things are going to hopefully get better, but then I believe they're actually going to tail off and get worse. The economic system is not sustainable. It is actually very unsustainable. The fact that all of these people keep talking about growth when it is pretty evident that the United States and the, quote, developed world, growth is impossible unless you go into undeveloped areas. And in order to go to undeveloped areas, that means you're going to have to exploit those people at diminishing returns. And ultimately, then they're going to become at least industrially developed, and you're not going to be able to extract as much from there. It's the way of cancer. It's not sustainable. So, you know, I have to really see what Donald Trump is going to do before I can say, you know, once and for all that we're going to end up in a third world nation when he's done. I don't know. But I have some suspicions. And as you can see in the clip that I put out there, that I just added, those suspicions are not favorable. They're not favorable, but, you know, I'm kind of glad that I did not put out a number of the episodes, which I recorded earlier last year, because while a lot of the material was good and it was relevant to the time, the conclusions were not accurate. And I've learned a lot from that, which is something that I don't know if I've ever been able to say about this podcast. I don't know if I've ever been able to say, well, I've learned from doing this podcast. I mean, of course, I've learned how to structure it and how to put together a decent show and all of that. But I'm talking about just in terms of looking at things and looking at the world and what have you. The podcast actually taught me stuff on that and my own deductive reasoning. So, you know, with that said, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you very much for giving me your time, ladies and gentlemen. I do ultimately, I appreciate it, and I really do love you all. I want you to stay safe, and to my European brothers and sisters, who it's hard to hear me say the things that I say sometimes, and you want to be mad. I get it. You respect your heritage. I get that too. But what I tell friends of mine, I say, listen, if you consider yourself white, then you're going to get the backlash. Dig deeper. What tribes did you come from in Europe? Oh, well, how do I find that out? Most of you have greater resources available to you than I do. Ask a librarian about tracing the tribal origins of Europe. And really, honestly, dig deep to find out who you are. Because as a good friend of mine found out, you know, he's Celtic. And I've talked to a number of friends who also are Celtic, and there's another one that I never can remember from over there, because it's not a typically known group, but they're prominent in the French area. But anyway, a lot of these tribes were actually warred against and wiped out when the Asiatic people, who we now see as European, came across. They're very warlike people, and they just tried to eviscerate and kill anything that, you know, moved and walked around. So some of you have that origins, and you should definitely find out, you know, if that is where you're at, and if it's not, if you happen to be Anglo-Saxon, if you happen to be the Germanic, if you happen to be some of them others who have done some of these great atrocities. Well, what I say is, your salvation could be near, and I mean that. We all have the opportunity to redeem, and I mean this too, to redeem our genetics. We have the opportunity to redeem our genetics. Just like if your great-grandfather, your grandfather, and your father are alcoholics, it predisposes you to being an alcoholic. Just like it does predispose you to be an alcoholic, it doesn't mean that you have to be an alcoholic. If you work diligently to work through the problems which leads to the alcohol consumption for you, then you can break that cycle. And it's not only important that you break the cycle, but you entrain it in your thought, in your mind, in your heart, because ultimately it is your mind and your heart that changes your genetics. You didn't know that, did you? It is your mind and your heart that changes your genetics, because both of them, well, everything really does, but both of them produce vibrations. Both of them produce vibrations, and those vibrations are key to the health and well-being of the body and to the functionability of the body. Without the brain and the heart producing, by the way, rather different vibrations, and yet succinct vibrations at the same time, without that happening, the body would cease to exist. So therefore, when you entrain in your mind, when you entrain in your heart, that new reality which you want to see from yourselves, you actually evolve the DNA. Again, thank you very much for listening. I really do appreciate it. Thank you for giving me your time. Thank you for giving me, you know, however many times you're going to listen to this. Thank you very much. I love you all. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone.